Welcome to Uprising. Each episode looks inside what it takes to lead the most dynamic and successful cultural movements. Some of them in the business world, some in the social realm, some in politics, and some in between. To see why people start uprisings, what gives those initiatives momentum and keeps them going, and most important, what lessons can you learn from these movements and how to apply them to your business and even personal life. Let's explore the secret to sparking movements that move people into action.
Passionate ideas.
Controversial ideas.
Uprising ideas.
The power is now in the hands of everyone.
To start a cultural movement.
Your movement.
To move the world.
Hello everyone, this is Scott Goodson and welcome back to Uprising, the show that focuses on movements, the people behind those movements, people who are idealists, people who want to see social change, people who have big ideas. I am truly honored today to have someone who I have gotten to know over the last year and have great respect for. Her name is Autumn Marie, and she represents the Black Lives Matter movement, which has become quite famous in the United States recently and very visible and very engaged in what are pretty significant issues in the United States. Some people call it the 21st century civil rights movement, but I think actually it has a larger role than that, if there is such a thing. Personally, I've never experienced segregated schools or I've never been denied the right to vote. I've never been stopped and frisked and never, you know, experienced bias in my career or in school. And I personally just, I can't discount Black Lives Matter as a movement by simply saying that, you know, all lives matter, because I don't think that would do justice to the struggle that my Black friends or colleagues or people of color have and have had for many, many years. I simply do not know what it's like to be a Black person in the United States, but I watch the news, I see what's going on. I don't know what I can do to help stop it. So I would like to welcome Autumn Marie on the show, and I'd love to ask you some questions about Black Lives Matter, just so, you know, I understand it and others perhaps understand it and how perhaps they can get involved. So maybe it'd be a good time just to, first of all, say hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. So yes, my name is Autumn Marie, and I am a organizer and member with the New York City chapter of Black Lives Matter's network.
I'm interested in you personally, like, when did you first become an activist? What happened in your life that you sort of woke up one day and said, you know, this is something I'm just really passionate about and I really want to, you know, get behind the movement? What happened? What, if you wouldn't mind telling me, I'd find it fascinating.
I was just born to a Black father, African in America, from Mississippi, and a Mexican / Chicana mother. You know, and born as a woman, you know, as a girl, that, you know, carrying those two identities, you know, growing up in Chicago. And it's, for me, it's as simple as that. I came out with that same type of inherent idea around equality that we talked about earlier. So as a child, like if I heard people making jokes about like adults or whoever, you know, making jokes about, it didn't matter if it was a Chinese person or whoever, you know, I was just like, you shouldn't say that. That's not right. So for me, it was always an inherent thing. And I never lost that child's inherent peace. You know, I think to just straight first, like, you know, I saw, I never had the question around, well, who can I call? Who can enable me? I never had a question about being enabled or being empowered. I never had a question about, can I do this, right? Or do I need someone else to do this for me? So, you know, I always tell people, like, you know, one of my earliest things was like when I think I was maybe 8, 9, I thought we needed more trees in the neighborhood. So I just went and found the phone book. We didn't have wow. Internet then. You know, I went and found the phone book and found Greenpeace. And I called and wrote a letter. And they tell me how long it would take to grow. And I was like, we don't have time like that. I'm 8. I can't even think about what 15 years looks like. And then, you know, things like when the war was going on in the early Iraq war. And I was in grade school. I think those troops, or no, it wasn't that. It was the Desert Storm. Pardon me. When it was like Desert Storm in like 92, I was like, this needs to stop, you know? And I wrote a letter to the White House because I was little and I was naive. And I thought that that's what you do is that you write a letter to the president and you tell them what you want changed. And I got that, you know, I got that generic letter back and I was like, oh, they read my letter. But I say those things to say that when I saw something that was wrong in my young mind, I was like, who can I tell? I didn't know the word power or understand power dynamics, but for me, that's what it really was in early stages. Who has the power dynamic to be able to change this? How do I write them a letter? How do they call them? And, you know, and then it formalized, you know, in high school we made, I actually forget what we ended up calling the group because we originally wanted to call it, I went to an all-girls school. We originally, actually me and another outspoken student who was there, she was a white student, come together and wanted to call it War, Women Against Racism. Hmm. We had to change the name because our private school thought that was, the acronym WAR was a little much for them. I forget what we ended up changing it to because I still like the acronym WAR. But, you know, and in college, I started another organization. So for me, you know, and during college, I became, when I was on break from college for like a year, a community organizer in Chicago and worked around alternatives to incarceration and diversion programs and balance and restorative justice when it was still, you know, burgeoning in its stages. And so for me, it was just those very inherent things from it was an inherent thing that that's how people should be treated. And then the more that I read, the more that I was educated around what was going on in the world, the more that I wanted to get involved, the more that me as myself of growing up as a Black and Chicana woman, the more that I saw my own treatment, the treatment of my parents, the treatment of people in my community, the conditions that were around, and, you know, even being able to juxtapose that to perhaps the neighborhood, the affluent neighborhood that I went to high school in, you know, being able to see those differences, just the reality of it is what pushed me. So there wasn't a specific moment, like how some people have a moment of something that happened or that pushed them or when they felt empowered of like, this has to change. For me, it was really just my very existence, the conditions and that inherent peace.
If you could just let our audience know what Black Lives Matter is.
The term and phrase and affirmation and declaration, Black Lives Matter is used in several ways to the media, so I just want to make sure that people understand the different ways in which they often hear it used. So there was Black Lives Matter, the hashtag, which was developed by or started with Alicia Garza's post on Facebook in response and reflection to what happened with Trayvon Martin. And then she connected with Patrice Marie Colors Khan and Opal Tometi, and those are the three women that connected around the use of that hashtag when it originated following Trayvon Martin's murder. And then fast forward to Mike Brown's murder a couple of years later, there were organizers such as Darnell Moore in New York, who is a part of our chapter, and others who started to have conversations. And there were some conversations that were happening in parallel across the country about what would it look like to have Black people from across the country come into Ferguson to be able to give some physical support on the ground, to be able to see firsthand what was going on there, to be able to commune with that community. And this was in the aftermath of Mike Brown's murder and in the middle of the Ferguson uprising. And so,
can I just interrupt you for 1 second for those that aren't familiar with this? Can you just describe very, very briefly what happened in Ferguson and, you know, what?
So following the murder of Mike Brown by St. Louis police officer, you know, the community responded and in a way of people have to understand there were conditions that preexisted that this made it the straw that broke the camel's back for this community that had already been dealing with all types of issues with the police beyond just police murder. A lot of it was also around policy. A lot of it has to do with how the counties and the districts are broken up and laws and different things, to the fact that a lot of that policy has been
change, right, following up with the organizing that has followed Mike Brown. So these were issues that were already pre-existing, the racial tensions, you know, the fact that they have things like the Veiled Prophet that take place there, you know, that come out of a very white supremacist background and foundation. And so what happened was is that when Mike Brown was killed by this police officer, his body was left laying in the street for 4 hours in the August sun. And if anyone's ever been in St. Louis, it is extremely hot in August. So his body was just left there bleeding out. They would not let his father go near, touch him, any of that. And so you have this, if you think about it visually, you have this black body of this young man, right, who is just getting ready to start college. You're not talking about someone who's even an adult, not that that makes it any better, but just thinking about how that moves the community and traumatizes the community. So now all of the community is outside and they're watching this happen. And for 4 hours of seeing the neglect of the police department, ambulance, the coroner, all of that, of them just allowing his body to sit there on almost this public display on the ground and watching the blood seep out into, right, the concrete. And so I say all of that visually so that people can understand what happened and why the community went to the police, to the police station that night and was demanding answers to know what happened and accountability. And when those answers and that accountability was not given, when the community went to the police station, there was an uprising, you know, that people saw on TV that included, you know, that included a rebellion in terms of building some buildings that were burned in, on a main street there that was near what happened. And that was really, you know, it was a cry of the people crying out about what had been done. And the fact that, you know, when you see rebellions and there were, you know, it's phrased as looting or rioting, it really is. It's the language of the people that cannot take anymore and have used every other form of language beforehand and before resorting to that.
I think a lot of people saw that. I mean, I certainly did. And it changed me, or I mean, I wouldn't say it changed me, it affected me very deeply. And do you think that that was the moment that Black Lives Matter became sort of a nationally visible movement?
So people saw that, and like how you're saying, people were definitely moved. For myself, being here in New York City and watching it as a Black woman, I just felt like I physically did not feel okay with myself, emotionally, spiritually, or physically, being in New York and not being there any longer. And I had a lot of friends who had gone in early on to offer support, you know, just support with infrastructure, organizing, taking supplies, whatever was needed. And I could not take it because what we were seeing on TV wasn't even so much about the uprising, it was about the militarization. And we had never seen that in our generation and in our lifetime. It made the pictures of the civil rights dogs chasing, you know, Black people at protests, it brought that to life for us in a whole new form, in a whole new militarized form. And that's what we saw in Ferguson with, I don't like to call people protesters because it sounds like you're just in the street protesting something. It sounds like there's not a plan. It sounds like you're not organized. So I'm going to say with organizers and activists, because that's what these people were who were out. That's what these people from the community were. So you saw pictures of organizers and activists with their bodies literally on the line, and organizers and activists who had no weapons and who were really out in the street protesting peacefully because they just wanted answers. They wanted a name. They wanted to know, at the very least, tell us who was this officer. Give us his name. And there was no release of a name. So anyhow, watching that, I didn't feel okay being in New York anymore and not being there because I felt like these people had been putting their bodies on the line for, at that point, almost 2 weeks and taking a hurting physically and in every other way and basically weren't even sleeping because they were out constantly. So I, you know, I think people across the country felt that way and were definitely moved by those photos in so many different ways. So people organized these rides to come in from across the country for that Labor Day weekend of 2014. And so rides came in from across, from LA, New York, Chicago, everybody can think of, buses came in full of Black people, all different backgrounds of Black people, all different social classes, all different professions of Black people that came to come speak to people in Ferguson, to come lend support and to come have conversation.
When these images were broadcast on television, did people around the country, such as yourself, just say, wow, I've got to, you know, I've got to go there, I've got to help out? Was that basically how people got there, or was there, I mean, how did it actually happen, you know, that people got to Ferguson?
People were already on the ground. So there were some people that had already, there were some organizers that immediately when that happened, got on a plane and went in and connected people on the ground. Also, although there were people who were, you know, that had, that were new organizers out of a response to what happened, there are also organizations like Organization for Black Struggle that has been, that have been in St. Louis and has been an active community organization for decades, right? And so they're very connected to another organization, not in Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. So there are already some organizations that pre-existed that people easily connected with. So things didn't happen, things don't happen in the silo. You know, there are organizers that are connected across the country. And, you know, from seeing even those who are being active, it was easy for people to get on the ground and connect and say, hey, what do you need? How can we support? And to connect with the organizations that were on the ground, as well as the new emerging organizers. And so people that some of us knew who are, you know, seasoned organizers that were there, we were already in contact with them. They were already in contact with the community, and they were already offering support to the community. So these bus rides came in. After the bus rides and after the weekend, people who went back decided they wanted to continue some of the same work with the people they had come in with, and that they wanted to do it under the Black Lives Matter name. And so a network was birthed with chapters that number almost 50 across the country, Toronto, and other places globally. And that is the network, and that is the her story of the network and how it came to be. And so these chapters are across the country and are doing work centered around what is happening local. And that is the basis of the work, so that each chapter does their own work. You know, our principles are around fighting anti-Blackness. And so that's the network. And then you hear Black Lives Matter movement, which is really a term that was given by the media as a way to talk about what was happening across the globe in this larger movement that is happening right now, because you saw everybody in the streets from here to China with signs that said Black Lives Matter, because it is a very fierce, it is a very poignant statement. It is an affirmation. It's a declaration. In itself, it is a form of protest to even be able to say that to some. So they started to term the entire movement of what is going on as the Black Lives Matters movement. That movement that they're talking about is made up of individuals. It is made up of several organizations, you know, tons of organizations. It's basically made up of all of those who believe that Black Lives Matter. That is the movement. And then there's the Movement for Black Lives, which is an actual movement or an umbrella that people within the movement who have similar focus and work have come together, including ourselves as Black Lives Matter, have come together under that umbrella. And that is the policy platform. I say all of that to circle back to the question around seeing, you know, what was happening in Ferguson and just the fact, the trauma of it, and the fact that, you know, we had never seen that in this generation. And so what is actually going on is that Black Lives Matter's movement is not something that is separate from what has happened beforehand. Black people have been resisting in this country since they first arrived to Jamestown in 1619. And I'll actually go further and say Black people have been resisting since the moment they first started being captured in Africa and were put on the ships and were jumping overboard or were having rebellions on the ships themselves on the way here. You know, Black people have been resisting as we have Birth of a Nation out since the times of Nat Turner, since before Nat Turner, and since after that. And so this is actually what is going on now is actually part of that same lineage of a Black liberation struggle that is connected to the civil rights movement, that is connected to the Black power movement, that is connected to, you know, the desegregation movement, that is connected to everything that has come before it, because without those movements, we would not be here where we are right now. We wouldn't have the strides that we've made before now, and the next generations that come after us won't have the strides from what we made. So there's really no way to separate us out from that. We carry all of that.
What is the wrong that you think needs to be righted?
White supremacy and white privilege. And, you know, white supremacy and white privilege also, you know, uphold capitalism, and capitalism pushes it, right? So the way that white supremacy and white privilege is ingrained. And I think, you know, it's interesting because sometimes when people ask, it's almost like people are looking for this simplistic one answer that is very solvable, right? Because people want to say, okay, well, how can we get rid of it? And people need to understand that it is a very complex and heavy issue beyond understanding of, you know, one conversation of what Black people carry on their back in this country, you know, and the fact that we still have the remnants of slavery, because this is a country that has been built, you know, this is a country's foundation and whose quote unquote founding fathers built this around protecting white men's rights. And so we're dealing with something that's been in existence for 400 years and not something that was just invented yesterday, and that the systems and institutions in this country, though some have been reformed to a certain extent since then, but they still come out of that same foundation. So it's not a simplistic answer. And I think what we need people to understand who challenge it or who are looking for this simple, a simple response or a simple solution is that, you know, there is privilege or white privilege or lack of understanding when people think that there's even just this one thing. If we just fix this one thing, or if we just fix these five things, there is an entire system that needs to be undone. You know, that also includes personal bias, because everything about schooling and everything else here upholds that same personal bias. It upholds that same privilege, that same entitlement that people receive. So it really is the white supremacy. It really is the white privilege.
In Germany, you may be aware of this, but in Germany today, they teach in elementary school all children about the Holocaust and about you know, what happened in Germany, what happened in, you know, in the political system there, and the consequences of that. And as a result of that, there is a deeper understanding for not only, you know, people, Jewish people, but you know, people of different backgrounds. But the most important thing is they basically have, you know, talked about as something that is incredibly painful in history. Why is that not something people are prepared to talk about here?
The average person does not want white guilt, because the average white person, when they come into it, there's a sense of like, I'm not responsible for that a lot of times, or a sense of like, of sometimes of the white guilt, right? Mm-hmm. And figuring out how to deal with that. That is a different, you know, that's a different struggle.
Now look at my children, for example. They, I think they have had some discussions of the past and slavery and the wrongs that existed in there. But I think, you know, intuitively they have a strong, they're repulsed by, you know, any, anyone who's not seeing the world in the way that, you know, people should see the world, which is that everybody should be equal.
Children come out with that ability and with that desire, like that natural instinct and desire to see people as being equal until taught otherwise, right?
Do you
children come out with that thought?
I just wonder, are there, I mean, obviously this is not a simple issue that, or, you know, needs, but sometimes, you know, simple ideas can help change. You know, I wonder whether, you know, a fighting for education, but also, you know, being able to stand up and say, hey, let's recognize the fact that this is what happened to a people in this country that you know, needs to be accepted and needs to be, you know, admitted. And once we do that, we're going to be all better off for it.
So I think part of it is there's a whole lot of history that is just not talked about in this country, right? Yeah. There's this revisionist, convenient history that is taught in schools so that, you know, right now we sit at the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party that is approaching in a couple of weeks at the anniversary of the founding by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. Very few people learn anything about the Black Panthers in school. What they learn is that there was this militant group who had guns, who wore leather jackets, and maybe they learned a couple of other things, and they learned that they had shootouts with the police. They do not learn about the breakfast program. They do not learn that the reason that there is a breakfast program in public schools across this country is because the Black Panther Party started a free breakfast program and moved by their actions and the education institution to actually relook and rethink that. They don't learn that the Black Panther Party was in neighborhoods testing for sickle cell anemia because people had no other way to be tested when it's, or for testing for lead paint, you know, taking over houses or vacant buildings to have housing for people in communities. They don't learn any of these things about the people's groceries program, the people's, you know, shoes and clothing programs that were going on about the Black Panther Party. And so it's not even just about slavery, it's about also just learning the real history of what happened across this, on this, this country in general. You can't, and so slavery is a part of it, but it's also, they just had Columbus Day. We live in a country that still celebrates a white man that landed somewhere where people were already living and said that he discovered something, right? The heart of like white privilege and white supremacy is that you discovered something and that you now repackage it as yours. You now claim it and repackage it as yours. The same thing that now we see happening with cultural appropriation all the time. And so claimed it as, you know, and gave it a name, thought he was somewhere else, gave it a name. And then everyone came over and started raping, killing, exterminating indigenous people. And, you know, where we now have a very small amount of indigenous people left, you know, in this country. And so it's about telling the truth about all of these things that have been revisioned and given as convenient history. So in living in this country, Thanksgiving being celebrated and what the root of that is, right, and where that comes from, and with the slaughter of the Pequot people in the Northeast and the roots of that, and then proclaiming, let us have Thanksgiving. So there's so much of this history that has to be redone. I do think that there's power in that, though, because one of the things that Black Lives Matter, as well as other organizations in Chicago, push for around the standoff that they've been having is that, you know, John Birch there was responsible for torture of a lot of Black men in Cook County Jail. And there has been prosecution going on with him. It's been a huge thing in Chicago for several last years. But one of the things that they've pushed for, in addition to them getting that prosecutor, Anita, removed in their Buy Anita campaign, was also that children in schools in Chicago be taught about this torture that happened when John Birch was in office. Because like what you're saying, they are like, we have to talk about the wrong that happened. And that when we talk about that, and if our children are learning that, it's under that same premise of what you're talking about, then if they grow up and they get involved, you know, they are involved, they can have a different understanding of what happened, what cannot happen again, what cannot be repeated. Right. So I do think that there's power in what you're saying. I'm just saying that in addition, there's so many steps. And I think that is a step that needs to be taken. Right.
There's such interesting history. A couple of years ago, I actually traveled with my family to Haiti and spent time traveling around the country there. We spent some time in an orphanage. But I came across, you may be familiar with the story, but there was a gentleman by the name of Henri Christophe. Do you know who he is?
Mm-mm.
So Henri Christophe was a slave who fought during the American Revolution and ended up moving or being taken back to Haiti. He actually became, he led a slave rebellion in Haiti and became the first king of Haiti. He was a very cultured man. He defeated Napoleon's forces and built what is the largest citadel in the West. It's actually larger than any other fort existing today, anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. He was a leader. He educated the Haitian black, he basically freed the slaves. And as a result of that, you know, Haiti became a pariah. A lot of the images that we have of Haiti today as being an island that's scary and full of dangerous voodoo and all these things were obviously mythologies that were created by Western countries because, you know, nobody wanted a slave rebellion. Nobody in Europe, the French didn't want to broadcast it, the British didn't like it, and the Americans didn't want that story. So it became a very isolated community. But what I loved about his story was here was a really cultured black leader, right? The king, the first king of Haiti, was a good man, was an educated man, did a lot of things for black people. And, you know, we never hear about that. We never hear about those stories or those leaders. You know, there are leaders out there that, like him, who I think are fascinating. And do you think that that's something that Black Lives Matter could stand for, like identifying leaders? Because I think as you dive down into details, like you're talking about, a lot of people, you lose people because we're living in a time of just people are so distracted and attention spans are the, you know, like people have attention spans like gnats. So, you know, can Black Lives Matter stand for just leadership, you know, black leadership? Are those some of the things that, you know, I wouldn't call it superficial level because it's not superficial, but it certainly isn't, let's revise all of history because that obviously is going to take more than our lifetime, right, to happen. Is there simpler things like identifying leaders?
What do you mean, leaders from the past who correct. People are not familiar with?
Exactly.
That's a part of it, right? So that's a part of when we say, you know, the real history. I think, and that for, you know, that for activists and organizers is what is known as political education. Or in New York, our chapter, you know, has something called Communiversity. And that's a huge part of it is, you know, making sure that you know our unsung heroes who people don't, and sheroes who people don't know. And that's why specifically, that's why we tell the story of the founding of Black Lives Matter, because 30 years from now, people may not know who Alicia, Patrice, and Opal well. And that story may be told, you know, the Black Lives Matter story may be told in three sentences, and their names may never be mentioned. That's why we make it a priority to make sure that we mention their names so that people can hear them. For that reason. So, you know, knowledge is power.
Do you think that there are a lot of people, maybe even a majority of Americans, who are with you that are not black?
There are varying levels of that. And so I say that to say that I do not think that non-black majority of Americans get it. If we did, we would be in a different situation than we are in now. If we did, there would be a different push for reparations and for other pieces, right, that of what needs to happen. I do think that the larger majority of Americans are completely taken by the amount of violence and murders, of police murders and, you know, the atrocities that have been happening to black people. But I do think that the larger, like, majority is taken by those when it's a shock and awe situation. So, for instance, situations like Sean Bell, you know, getting ready to get married, you know, 50 shots, things like that. And I do think that when it's captured on camera, when it's a shock and awe thing, because otherwise what we see is that when it's not such a clean, clear thing, is that we're still having the time. We look at it, you know, on social media and everywhere else, but we still have to explain that we should be focused on what happened versus the, you know, what type of person this was. Because the first thing that we see when a murder like this happens to a black person is if they've ever been arrested for anything, even if it was like petty theft, you know, when they were 17, the first thing that we see is a mugshot, or the first thing that we see is a story that comes out and it all becomes alleged and what type of person this was, right, that completely tries to smear their character, question their character, versus looking at it as this is someone who was just murdered, whether by a vigilante or by the police. And we don't see that happen when white people are murdered. And so what we don't see is like the larger society
when it's not a shocking or clear thing, always standing up. Like, they're like, oh, well, let's see what happened. And so I do think if people got it in its full capacity, then they would understand and they would see the difference of why there's standoffs, you know, and how what happens when there's police standoffs with white people.
I see
versus what we're seeing.
I mean, personally, I have been in think tanks and idea conferences in the last year or so, and I can tell you from my own experience, there is a lot of momentum behind, I would say, from a sort of a, you know, the idea of trying to solve this issue. There's a lot of discussions today around the injustice of the wealth, and then, of course, you know, the de-evolution of the middle class and all that stuff. And, you know, part of, I think, on a macro level, part of the Black Lives Movement is directly connected to that, right? It's like social injustice is not simply a racial issue. It is an issue that affects a lot of people, but, you know, it's manifested through things like attacks on Black communities, for example. But, you know, do you think as the economic challenges, you know, become harder, that this issue is going to become, I don't know, a beacon to help us? Because it's something for all of us that is something to wake people up, you know? If there's going to be social change, it feels like this is something that people are seeing, that they can identify, and that, you know, and when I say identify, they obviously, it may not be easy to identify as a Black man, you know, but I think, or woman, but I think they identify, right, with this type of being in the face of militarism or being in the face of poverty or whatever. I mean, I think a lot of people can identify with that.
I think that people can identify with struggle, but I think that if people largely could identify with it, we wouldn't see all the pushback for All Lives Matter and such a challenge of the term Black Lives Matter. But what I do agree with you in is I do think what has happened with social media, both from conversation as well as with the videotaping and, you know, the public sharing of that and the citizen journalism that has emerged from that, right, and the empowering of citizen journalism, is that this problem has been brought to light, right? So police brutality, stop and frisk, all of this is nothing new in communities, right, and in certain Black and brown communities, Black and Latino communities. But this has, what we've seen in the last couple of years and with Black Lives Matter has really brought that to the forefront. And it's pulled the curtain back on America and on the farce of what happens here and how America treats, the U.S. rather, treats its people to the world. And also to people who perhaps were living somewhere in the suburbs and who were going along with the myth that things had been corrected, or that, you know, we were living in a country that gave certain equal rights, or that everyone had the same opportunity to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. It pulled its curtain back in a large way, I think, to the country and to the world. And I do think what it did do is that it has made people nationally really rethink the condition of the country. So they're already looking at it from an economic standpoint and things that directly affect them. But I do think that it has made them uncomfortable and to question what's going on in terms of how this country is treating Black people to a large extent. So I do agree on that level. And people, I think, are outraged. And there are some simple things around it that people in general are like, you know, can agree is not right, which is why, like, when you see, you know, when the officer was acquitted or was not indicted with Eric Garner, you know, you saw massive protests of people from all different backgrounds, all different races, everything. But again, that's because it's, you know, it was a shock and awe situation where you're seeing this man killed in his chokehold saying, "I can't breathe," on camera. And so it's something that was almost unquestionable around his human rights violations with it. The more people hear statistics, the more that people are able to grasp what is going on in this country and what has been going on in this country.
It seems to me that the issue of reparations is something that would be a really good and smart focus. I think it's one of those things, you know, with all the issues associated with this, that to me seems to be the one about fairness. And I think America, at least, you know, the part of the mythology of America is that it's a country of fairness. And it seems to me that that would be the thing that people could get behind. I mean, look, for example, at what happened last year when it came to light that Georgetown University, you know, one of the most respected universities in the United States, was basically a Jesuit college that had slaves, and then they were, you know, sold, yeah. And then they came out and they said, okay, you know, we're going to try and show that we are good citizens by letting, you know, any of the families that were sold come back right. And be educated for free. Sounds a little bit light in my opinion.
Yeah, late, and also like, but, what about everyone else who was affected in yeah, general, which but, you did in general? But I guess, it's a start. It's a start.
But to me, it's a sign. I think there's a bigger sign that there is an appetite for that among the civilized institutions and...
Well, we want reparations, so we are definitely for that. And there's, you know, there's a large part and explanation around what that, you know, some of those asks are around that on the Movement for Black Lives Policy Platform site. You know, people have been asking for reparations. There's been a long history, Queen Mother Moore and many others, you know, who've been around reparations. There was the lawsuit, you know, the large corporate lawsuit that happened, I think, what, over a decade now, where J.P. Morgan Chase and others who profited well, insurance companies and others, from slave trade, you know, where there was a large national civil suit that was trying to be brought against them. So I think that we definitely want to have more concrete conversation and demands around what does that look like, because we are one of the, you know, people around the world that have not seen reparations. And, you know, we've seen reparations given to people from the Holocaust and from other backgrounds. So we definitely want to have conversations around what does that look like.
I mean, based on your personal experience, do you think that a lot of the problems we face in society could be solved if we just educated more girls?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, what did Malcolm X say? When we educate, you know, we educate a woman, we educate a nation. Mm-hmm. Definitely, you know, and I know that, you know, Michelle Obama, the First Lady, has, you know, a huge initiative going on around that right now. And I know she just had that large talk yesterday around it. And I definitely think that there is something to be said for that, because, you know, the same way that we talk about inequality in this country, we're still also looking to level out the inequality with women in this country, from everything of how much women earn to everything around how education has been prioritized for women in this country. So so there's definitely something to be said for that. The place that women, you know, women, how we emerge as leaders. So there's definitely a lot to be said for that. Last Friday, a week ago before that, I was at a wonderful event, Champions of Change, at the White House that celebrated those who are making community change for marginalized women and girls in their community. And there is some excellent work being done. And this administration has really celebrated and pushed and honored the work that is being done around empowering girls and educating girls.
I guess my last question would be, you know, if people are listening to this and they feel that this is, you know, a wrong that needs to be righted, what can people do? If people were really passionate about this and they felt they wanted to be a part of it, what can people like me do?
I'll give maybe 5 or 6 things, from basic to more involved. You know, trying, educating and listening with an open, unbiased mind. Recognizing and being willing to admit that there is a such thing as white privilege, and that those who are white, if you are a white person, that you've benefited from that, which, you know, is not always an easy thing and is a complicated thing, but that in itself, and being able to listen unbiasedly then, to write to what's being said and to research and to hear. So then, you know, you are understanding the conditions of what's going on. You know, the everyday things of, because for us, this is a human rights movement. It is a social justice movement. And it is also, it comes out of love for Black people. And so it's also just the everyday things. How are you treating people on an everyday level? How are you treating
Black people and people of color in general on a daily level. So for us, that means, and I say this all the time because I think people are oblivious to how much we go through this in a daily thing, of how much non-Black people bump into us and don't say, excuse me. That might sound like a small thing, but if you say it in a room full of Black people, you would be amazed at how much Black people all say, mm-hmm, at once, right? And how those little things that we go through that other people don't even realize happen to us are just like, what are you talking about? And we're like, no, really, it happens several times. And it makes us feel like we're not being seen in this world because how else could people bump into us all day and not say, excuse me? And it doesn't happen amongst ourselves. It's always with, you know, non-Black people. So I think those little things on how you treat each other, I think another thing you can do is like how we talked a lot about education for those that have children. I know y'all do a lot of work with moms too, just what you're teaching your children, you know, and being, you know, teaching around, because we all have to teach our children, all of us in this world, outside of what's being taught in school and outside of what the media teaches us, and education is so powerful. So I think that those are some simple everyday things that people can do. For those that get it and for those that believe that this is a problem, talking to those who don't get it, right, and having those hard conversations and explaining why you get it and explaining why this is an issue. So those are very simple everyday things that actually, if everybody did them, it makes a huge difference and it makes a huge change, you know, and then just keeping up with what's going on so that when there are policy changes that are coming to the table, that we can support them. And then looking at, instead of just being an ally, what does it look like to be an accomplice in the work? So those are my things, because I think sometimes we come with the large overarching things that are not as tactile, that people feel like they can't grasp. But sometimes it's about learning about those small everyday things, about talking to each other, about educating, about listening with an open mind to that experience so that it validates that experience and so that, you know, it gives a different understanding. And sometimes I think those things, if everyone did that, gives us a new reality.
Well, that's wonderful. With that, I'd like to say a really warm thank you, Anna Marie, for joining us today on Uprising.
Thank you. And thank you for the work that, you know, thank you for the work that you all are doing. I definitely want to follow up with you on some conversations about reparations, if that many people are in tune with it. And thank you for having conversations that matter, and for getting those conversations out to other people around the world that can really listen and sit with them around issues and movements and things that are happening. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. This show focuses on movements and the idealists behind them in society, in culture, in business, and in life. If you have a movement that you want to talk about, please let us know on our Facebook page. It's called Uprising Movements. And if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes and tell your friends. This is Scott Goodson with Anna Marie today. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
See you soon.
Day.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you for joining our Uprising today and listening to our show. If you missed the show, or if you want to find out more about who was on, or if you want to learn more about how to create your own Uprising, please go to uprisingmovements.com. You can also download this Uprising program from iTunes. Uprising was produced by Nicola Keneally and Adam Helen, with special help from Melanie Boardman, Karin Drakenberg, Philippa Freeman, Brianna Campbell, Fashad Faroudi, Mark Bruzzi, Will Isom, James Politi, and Jonathan Weeks. My name is Scott Goodson, and you've been listening to Uprising, what we can learn about movements and uprisings that are shaping our world in business, in society, and in between. For more on cultural movements and movement marketing, be sure to pick up a copy of the best-selling book Uprising, How to Build a Brand and Change the World by Sparking Cultural Movements, available on Amazon.com.
Music for Uprising composed by Charles Duchateau.